Tonight's scripture reading is Genesis 45. Genesis 45, verses 4 through 9. In this context, Joseph is now a leader in Egypt. His brothers have come seeking food, not recognizing who he is. And in this context, Joseph is going to reveal that to his brothers. So starting in verse number 4, "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'Please come closer to me.' And they came closer. And he said, 'I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me here before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve you for you a remnant in the earth, and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his household, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not delay.'"
I'm sorry, I was unprepared and hadn't already done the microphone thing yet. Just a minute. Well, after being gone for about a month and home on some Sundays, but I was gone last Sunday and I really, really missed all of you. It's really nice to be back. And what I want to preach about today, I wrote this up, and then I thought, well, I really hope that the congregation doesn't think poorly of me for what I'm about to tell you. So I'll start with this, and I hope that I don't irreparably damage my reputation, but went and saw Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat the other day. And I went there because the girls had seen that it was put on and is the local production here. And so Lena was going to be out of town at the ladies' retreat, and the girls saw it and said, well, you know, maybe we could go see that. Now, when I was a kid growing up, that thing came out in like the 70s or something like that. And when I was a kid growing up, I remember mom and dad saying that it was kind of bad. I don't really remember why. And so I said, well, sure, we can go see that. And so we did. And I asked Addie before I was going to do this, because it was kind of her idea. And I said, you're not going to be mad if I do this lesson on that, am I? Are you? And she said, no. She said it was a good idea. So I got her permission to talk about what I'm going to talk about today, tonight. And in a way, I'm glad I went. And I'm glad I took my daughters, too, because, you know, sometimes it's difficult to see light if there's not darkness, right? So I wouldn't go see it again. But not because it wasn't well done. As a matter of fact, for something you see in Ridgecrest, I mean, these people, there's a lot of talented folks. And it was really rather outstanding. They had the full orchestra pit. As a matter of fact, I had flashbacks to mom and dad. Every so often we would go down as a family to see some presentation at Pantages down south. And I always remember thinking it was so neat. That there was this full orchestra pit down there, all full of people. And sure enough, they had that, and the orchestra sounded great, and all the singers sounded great. And, you know, the music's kind of compelling at a lot of points, and you can't complain about it that way. I mean, it's a little strange. It's got some 70s things going on. But otherwise, from a quality perspective, I thought it was really well done. I can't complain about it from that aspect. But every so often, I'd hear a line, and I went back and I made sure I found these things verbatim so that I'm not making this stuff up. This isn't just something that, I mean, this was actually what was sung about, and so I'm sure some of you maybe have seen this before, so you know where I'm going with this. But first of all, the rough story here in the musical. Okay, in the musical, here's how it goes. Joseph is this young fellow. Now he has, he's got a little bit of that, you know, when we were growing up, King James, I think, has something about a many-colored coat. That's I guess a mistranslation, but that's kind of what this is all based on, right? That starts with. This is his amazing technicolor dream coat, because his dad gives him this coat, the coat of many colors, that is that makes his brothers jealous because dad loved him more than his brothers. And he starts having dreams, okay? So he starts telling his brothers these dreams. And he tells his parents these dreams, and they get a little upset with him, because their dreams of them bowing down to him and their dreams of the sheaves, and the sheaves all bow down to the one, and then their dreams of the sun and the moon and the stars and them bowing down to him. And so they're jealous. They're filled with jealousy. And so one day the brothers, he goes out into the fields to visit them, and the brothers decide to kill him. But then, of course, they decide not to kill him, and they sell him off into slavery instead. And so he gets sold off to these passing traders, and the passing traders then sell him off into Egypt, and he gets sold into the house of Potiphar. Now, Potiphar, what does Potiphar do with him, right? He's doing well there. He's successful. But his wife accuses him. She first tries to get him to go to bed with her, and then when he doesn't, she accuses him of these things, and so Potiphar has him thrown into jail. And in jail, he does pretty well for himself, but he runs into the cupbearer and the baker, Pharaoh. The cupbearer and the baker, Pharaoh, one night have these dreams, and they're worried about these dreams, and so they tell him, well, we've had these dreams. And he says, well, okay, and he interprets the dreams for them, and they're amazed. And he says, well, just don't forget about me, stuck over here in jail. And so they get out. Of course, the baker's put to death in accordance with his dream, and the cupbearer goes back to be with Pharaoh. And Pharaoh, cupbearer forgets about him, though, and he goes back, and some time passes, and one day Pharaoh has a dream, and he's really troubled about this dream. And so the cupbearer tells him, you know, I knew a guy in jail who could interpret dreams. And so he tells the Pharaoh says, okay, we'll get this guy, bring him in here. And so they bring Joseph in. And, of course, Joseph can interpret Pharaoh's dream as well. And he does. And he tells him there's going to be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. And you ought to get ready for it. And Pharaoh says, well, great. You know, it'd be nice to have this, you know, we need a guy who can help us. And you seem to be that guy. And so he gets Pharaoh, and he puts him in charge, second in charge of the kingdom. Pharaoh prepares everything, and so Egypt starts making it through the famine better than all the rest of the, you know, world around it. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, back at with Israel and his sons, the famine's bad there, so they need food. So they go, and they finally go to Egypt, and of course, there they recognize. They don't recognize Joseph, but Joseph recognizes the brothers. And so he does what we're kind of familiar with, right? He accuses them of being spies, and they say, no, we're not spies. And then he says, well, okay, he gives them some food, but he tosses the cup in the top of one of the sacks, and then he finds the cup. They shorten up this section a bit, and because it all happens pretty fast right there. And, you know, there's several whole chapters built on this in the Bible, but they kind of compress that a bit. And so the brothers then eventually are reunited with Joseph, and as well as Jacob's also reunited with Joseph, and all ends pretty well at that point. Now, I told you, I kind of walked you through this, and I hope you were thinking, well, what's wrong with that? I mean, that kind of sounds like what the Bible says, because really it marches along fairly, hews fairly close plot-wise to the Bible. It's used a lot closer plot-wise to the Bible than like that movie Noah that came out recently, which just seemed to sort of have the name and then some rain and maybe a boat. And that was pretty much it, right? So the musical did better. One of the first real lines, really hit me and stuck was this one that I want to read to you. Okay, so after Joseph has been named second in command of all Egypt, all right, after Pharaoh. So this is the apex of his life. All these bad things have happened, and now you finally understand the reason for all these dreams. And he sings this this in the song Stone the Crows. He sings, "Anyone from anywhere can make it if they get a lucky break." So now you begin to see, right? We got all the plot lines. We got all the plot happening here from the Bible. But we're missing something. Anyone from anywhere can make it if they get a lucky break. The closest that the musical ever gets to mentioning that there's some other reason why Joseph succeeds other than luck and skill is when the narrator sings, "Go, go, go, Joseph, you know what they say. Hang on now, Joseph, you'll make it someday. Don't give up, Joseph, fight till you drop. We've read the book and you come out on top." Now, the "we've read the book and you come out on top" is the closest they get. That is the closest they get. There's nothing closer than that to saying why all this stuff has happened. Why all the dreams? Why the fact he can interpret them? And he does get, he kind of, maybe sort of, talks about it. I'm really trying to be as charitable as I can be here. "Keep those I love for me, children of Israel, are never alone, for we know we shall find our own peace of mind." Okay? So that's as close. That, I'm really being as charitable as I can be. Anybody is free to go. The great thing about the internet is all the lyrics are out there, right? The entire, I called it a musical. I guess it's more appropriately, an opera, because it's there's no part that's speaking, right? So it's end-to-end singing. And so it's not just the song lyrics, but you can have the lyrics to the entire thing. And you can go search through them, and you feel free to do that. This is the closest two passages I found that charitably could be held to have anything to do whatsoever with the other character in the story, right? The other big piece, the kind of elephant in the room that nobody talks about. So what is the story of Joseph actually about? Is it about this young kid that has a little bit of luck and a little bit of skill, and he's scrappy and individualistic, and he works his way forward, he does a good job, and he puts in his hours at the jail, and that's why the guy at the jail likes him, and he's a hard worker, and that's why Potiphar liked him, and too bad for the wife thing, you know, that kind of shot him in the foot there, you know. But is that what the story's all about? Is that the lesson that we take from that story? In Genesis 39, 2 through 3, this is after he's sold into Egypt. Genesis 39, 2 through 3, it says, "The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands." And again, down in verse 9 of Genesis 39, "He is not greater in this house." This is Joseph talking now to the wife when the wife has said, you know, "Hey, come lie with me." Joseph says, "Potiphar, he is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Right, so Joseph has an understanding that God is playing a role here, that he is not to sin against God. That part, by the way, also doesn't figure into the story in the musical. In the musical, they're kind of caught in this act that's kind of misinterpreted, which is really a bit of a pejorative cast on poor Joseph there, right? Because in the Bible, there's no mention of that at all. He says no, and runs away so fast that he leaves his cloak behind with her, and that's what she uses, because she keeps it with him. She keeps it with her until Potiphar comes home and then uses that as a weapon. That part's not in the musical either. But neither is Joseph saying that, "How could I do this and sin against God?" He doesn't say that. He says, no, I don't want to do this. No. And he has this kind of semi-moral struggle, but moral why? Because, you know, there's no mention of any other higher power. Again, down in verse 21 of Genesis 39, it says once again, "But the Lord..." Now see, this is after, remember, his life goes like a series of these ups and downs, right? First of all, dad loves him a great deal, but he gets sold into slavery, but he ends up with Potiphar, and he does really well, and he gets placed over all of Potiphar's house, but then Potiphar puts him in jail, and so he's got these ups and downs, and the downs, he gets put in jail. And after each down, after each big down, right, so after the first big down, it says, but the Lord was with Joseph. That's the same phrase again that we find in Genesis 39:21, right after the next big down when he's dropped into jail. It says, but the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Okay, it doesn't say anything about him being a hard prison worker or a good prisoner. It says that God specifically bent the mind and heart of the keeper and made him show him steadfast love and give him favor. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. Just like Potiphar had figured out, well, this kid succeeds. Why? Because the Lord is with him. And the jailer also figured out, everything he touches, you know, turns to gold because the Lord is with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. The Lord, not him, not his luck, not his skill, but the Lord. Genesis 40:5-8, we now run into the dreams from the cupbearer. At one night, they both dreamed. The cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in custody in his master's house, "Why are your faces downcast today?" They said to him, "We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." Now back to the musical real quick. So what happens in that part of the musical? In the musical, right before Joseph hears the dreams, he sings the following. He says, "Tell me of your dreams, my friends, and I will tell you what they show. Though I cannot guarantee to get it right, I'll have a go." All right. So it's like he's like, I'm just taking a shot at this, right? As a matter of fact, I made that face. That actually is a face he makes a little bit later when Pharaoh has called him in. And he's supposed to interpret Pharaoh's dream. He's worried. And he runs around. And he'd like to get out of it. He doesn't want to interpret it, right? Because he's worried. Now there's so much on the line. Before it was just a plaything, right? To mess around with dream interpretation. I mean, after all, you know, I mean, somebody wakes up, but I had a dream. Oh, that sounds like an omen, right? And so that's kind of what it sounds like in the musical. In the musical, when Joseph tells the baker what his dream means, he says to the baker, of course, he doesn't give him good news. He says, "Sad to say, your dream is not the kind of dream I'd like to get. Pharaoh has it in for you. Your execution date is set." You like this. This is why I'm reading this. "Don't rely on all I said I saw. It's just that I have not been wrong before." So once again, right, it's not, there's no mention of any dream interpretation from God. Like Joseph says in Genesis 40:8, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell the dreams to me." That's not in the musical. In the musical, it's, well, I'll take a guess. And then when he gives the baker some bad news, it's, maybe I'm wrong. I haven't been wrong before. Who knows? Right? It's kind of like Adrian Monk. You know, well, I could be wrong, but I'm not. Right? So, but it's all him. Right? It's all in his head. He happens to be a really good interpreter of dreams, I guess, or really lucky, right? With a little, anyone from anywhere can make it if they get a lucky break, right? That kind of is that pivot point in the beginning that I mentioned. Genesis 41:14-16. "Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they quickly brought him out of the pit. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came in before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'I've had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it.' Joseph answered Pharaoh, 'It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer.'" Now, this is the same as another famous character in the Bible, right? So Daniel says the same thing. "I'm not the one interpreting the dream. You're going to get an interpretation, but it's from God." And Joseph actually specifically tells him, "You've looked to me, you've brought me in here, but it's not in me. I just happen to be the only faithful one here who's going to give you the answer. I just happen to be God's conduit. But it is not in me. and God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Now, Joseph understood. The reason I had Ron read that passage is because Joseph understood full well, right? You might think to yourself, maybe they took license with it. It was supposed to be from Joseph's viewpoint. I mean, we live in a world, right, where, I mean, everybody, you wonder, you pray and you hope that your prayer will come true, but everybody thinks, well, maybe Joseph was the same way. Maybe he didn't know that God was with him, and maybe he just hoped he was with him, or maybe he wasn't sure about the whole thing, right? But it says down in Genesis 41, 51 through 52, it says, Joseph called the name of his firstborn son Manasseh, for, he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Joseph lays at the feet, he lays his success, he lays the events of his life that have happened at the feet of God. He says, these things happened to me because of God. I'm successful in this land because of God. He actually goes further, of course, in the passage that Ron read part of, and I'm going to read 1 through 9. He's actually going to give credit to God for both the good and the bad, for it all, because he understands that the original dreams were sent by God, that they were sent for the purpose of his brothers kicking him out. I mean, as bad as that sounds, that's what the story says. The story basically says that God specifically sent him these dreams, and it roused the jealousy of his brothers, because God had a place for Joseph. He had something bigger he wanted him to do someplace else. His purpose was to save the family of Israel, and he needed him in Egypt to do that. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, "Make everyone go out from me." So no one stayed with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And he wept aloud so that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard it. And Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still alive?" But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth, and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and ruler over all the land of Egypt. Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, 'Thus says your son Joseph, God has made me lord over all Egypt.'" 4 times he gives the credit to God in this one short passage. 4 times he says the same thing. Not once does he ever say, "With luck and a little skill, you know, I can get forward with luck. You know, anybody can make it no matter where they're from. Even if they're just a sheep herder family, then, you know, it's all my lucky interpretive dreams. And, you know, I had these dreams, and so who knows?" He doesn't say any of that. It's all God has done this. God had this happen. God knew what was going to take place. God then becomes the main character in the story of Joseph. The story of Joseph is not as much about Joseph as it is about the fact that God is in control of all these events. He sends these dreams to Joseph. Now, for those dreams to have their effect requires several things to happen, right? Joseph, for some reason, his father favors him. Maybe it's because he was the oldest son of one of the sisters that he really truly loved. I don't know. But God favors Joseph. Now, his favoring of Joseph leads him to already not be liked by his brothers. So there's some jealousy going on. There's human emotions here are mixed up in this mess. And God uses that. He uses this imperfection. He uses this fleshly human thing, and he works with it. You can't thwart his plans. He just moves forward. And then he seems to kind of poke the jealousy factor, right? With these dreams. Joseph just seems not aware, or maybe he's I don't know how young he is when he decides to tell his brothers. Maybe he kind of is a little bit like, hey, y'all are going to bow down to me, my coat. Right, I don't know. And who knows? I mean, I've seen, you know, all of us, you've seen younger siblings poke the older one, or older poke the younger. We know how siblings are, right? And maybe that's what he did. But God sends him these dreams, and now the rest of the family is pretty jealous, right? And he stokes that a little bit. He's already jealous because dad favors him. And then God kind of stokes it a little bit with these dreams that he obviously sent him. And then what happens is, well, you know, if you think about the background, think about the fact that every event along the Bible story to this point in Genesis, all these little events have all trickled down here, and a bunch of them, a bunch of story points, all converge in the story of Joseph. Consider the fact that Reuben, right? Reuben has been, he was the firstborn. Now, in the firstborn, you didn't need to go fight for your rights in the Old Testament time. You know, you were the firstborn. You automatically got the lion's share of the inheritance. You automatically were the favored son. But what had Reuben done several chapters earlier? Reuben had already slept with one of his dad's, one of the concubines. He'd already displeased his father. It says, and Jacob found out about it. Now we know that Jacob was not happy with this because later on in the book of Genesis, when he essentially goes through and gives his blessing to each one of the brothers, he tells Reuben, you went up and violated my couch. So, but Reuben wants that favor back. So Reuben intends to save Joseph. He's kind of got this ace in the hole. So he talks them out of the initial killing. I mean, you can see all the events, and God's in command of all those. God's not going to let Joseph be put to death, so he doesn't. It's a little bit like watching a movie where the hero, you're not sure why, you know, but except in the Bible, we are sure why. But it's amazing how he keeps getting unscathed, and, you know, the bad guy starts monologuing, and then you're amazed that the good guy can live through that, and why does he just shoot him? You know, and the brothers who can't stand Joseph are like, yeah, we might as well like make a little money on the kid, you know. Let's just sell him off into slavery in Egypt. Nobody ever gets out of slavery. Yeah, you know, run off. Nobody's going to be bound down to him. Right? So they figured they're still good to go. But Reuben affects that first thing. So they doss him in the pit to save him for later. And Reuben's going to go save him, right? Because he wants to get that favor back. But, so God has used that event, that negative event, to save Joseph, to work within the minds of all these people that are going through all this stuff. And so sure enough, you know, he gets into Potiphar's house, and then he blesses him. He turns everything he touches well. And then God is with him all along. God is warping the story, saving the family of Joseph, of Israel, and carrying them forward, that the remnant would always be saved, that no matter what person tried to eliminate Israel, no matter what person tries to stop the hand of God, they can't do it. That's the story of Joseph. That's what the story of Joseph is about. The story of Joseph is not about luck and skill. It's not a story of, you know, an individual young American boy running off and working hard at things. That's not what that story's about. And the most amazing thing to me is that they kept, the musical keeps all, I realized to me that it must have taken a ton of work to scrub God so thoroughly from that story. I mean, that must have actually taken quite a bit. Actually, it's kind of impressive when you think about it afterwards. That the guys who wrote that, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, right, had put together all this work, and they really made quite a monumental effort to make sure that God was expunged from this story. Now, how thoroughly is God expunged from the story? I went through, just because, you know, we have the internet and you can do things like this so quickly now. I just pulled up all the lyrics from one of the sites that I was searching for, that I found these, that I copied out. And I said, well, does he even, because there's times when I can't hear very well, and they're singing, and, you know, the music's in the way. Maybe they mentioned God or something. The word God is not in the entire musical, not one single time. Well, you might say, well, Lord, maybe Lord's in there. No, the word Lord's not in there one time either. God, Lord, completely, utterly gone. Like he doesn't even exist, right? Like his presence cannot be acknowledged. I use the word acknowledge in closing here because in Romans 1:28, we find out why people do these things. Right? That it says, for they did not see fit to acknowledge God. Humans are flesh, the aspect of us. There's a part of us that doesn't want to acknowledge God. There's many people that seek not to allow him to play a role. They'll go so far as, and just stop and think about it for a minute. You put together a musical based on the Bible, you hew so closely to the plot line that I can give you the plot from the pulpit here, and you wonder, well, that sounds like the Bible, and it was, I mean, so you get the plot directly from the Bible story, yet you expunge God from it so completely. So you've gone through the added effort and energy to eliminate him, the central character, from a Bible story. Who does that? Why? Why would you do that? Because the flesh, the human mind, does not want, the mind that wants to seek its own, the mind that wants to do its own thing, turns the story of Joseph into a story of, and this is the whole, any dream will do, right? He's got dreams, and he follows his dreams off into the future, and, you know, he makes a big difference in the world with his luck and with his skill, right? Which is a great story for the modern man, and we yank it out of the Bible so that maybe Christians might go see it and not think twice, and the real point of the story is completely subversive to the whole point of the story in the Bible. It utterly is different. I don't know if you were, well, it's not playing anymore. So. I don't know if you were going to see it. Maybe you didn't get a chance to see the local one, and then you saw the billboards, and you said to yourself, well, wow, that came out in the 70s. Maybe I might want to go see that. But I'm here to tell you that the book was better, and you don't have to go see it because they just completely ruined it. And I am thankful though because my daughters caught that, and that gave me a lot of hope. They said, Dad, no, you should do this lesson because you're right. It was amazing. It was like God wasn't in there at all. It completely scrubbed him out of the whole story and made it about something completely different. The way of the flesh is to scrub out God from the life. The way of flesh is to take God and remove him from the life, try to, you know, excerpt him, even from Bible stories, even from places where you can't rub him out. We look around at the world around us, of course, and we say, look at creation speaks to God, and yet we have the atheists that say, no, no, all that just happened. No, God is not there. And we say, well, at least we can go to the Bible and God is there. And then we get some fellow like Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, and they come together and they decide, no, no, God's not even there either. And they take their scalpel and carefully remove God from his own story, from the story that he gave you. But that is not the way of salvation. That is not what we must do to be saved. The way of salvation does the opposite. It takes God and it puts him everywhere. Instead of removing him, even from the vestige areas, at least let him keep the Bible, right? I can't imagine trying to do a story from the Quran and then scrub out Allah or something like that. That'd be crazy. No, but the way of salvation instead does the exact opposite. We take God and we are to permeate our entire lives with him. Everything we do, everywhere we are. So we are to do the exact opposite of what the way of flesh does. The way of flesh does this scrubbing thing, to have a story of Joseph and then not talk about God. The way of salvation, though, takes God and puts him back into your life. Puts him in where he was missing. Puts him in where you had maybe tried to cut him out. If you're here this evening and you need to do this, you need to put God back in. You need to, maybe you've never put God back in. Maybe you've never put God into your life. That happens by putting on Christ, Galatians 3:27, in baptism, by repenting, by believing, by confessing. And we can baptize you today. If you're here and there's a tendency to do this, it starts with small things like busyness. Ran into a sweet girl just this morning. My friends invited me out for a quick birthday Starbucks this morning early. I went there. Didn't interfere with church, so I went there, got a quick cup of coffee, and see somebody else I know there, and she tells me she's ditching church because she's got homework to do, right? Well, so that's how it starts. It starts maybe on a slow slope, right? So you cut out, you cut God out of little pieces, little chunks, right? And before long, you're writing lyrics to a musical from the Bible and making sure he's not in there either. Okay, that's kind of a large jump. If you're starting down that road and you're starting to cut him out, you don't want to do that. And if you want to come forward for prayers at this time or for baptism, we're here. Would you come forward now as we stand to sing the song that's been selected?